This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
I'm caught up in the game. My attention is on every play and every whistle. But what I'm missing is a signal coming from my kidneys. That signal isn't like a ref's whistle. It's more of a silent SOS, which could be warning me of an increased risk for events like heart attack or stroke. And a way I can catch that signal? A simple urine test called UACR. If you have type 2 diabetes or high blood pressure, talk to your doctor about the UACR test. Detect the SOS. Visit detectthesos.com to learn more.
Good evening and welcome to Amplify, a program that reflects on life from both spiritual and secular perspectives. I'm Father Ron Lingwin, hoping you have felt the warmth of God's love in your life today. We all need to have that in the world in which we live, but especially the joy you feel when you then share that love of God with others, hopefully helping to promote peace among as many people as we can. And we begin the program each week with a story that is based on faith and formed with imagination. It was created by a friend of mine after she had reflected on sacred scripture. And my hope is that it will help you to focus both your heart and mind on the topic we're going to explore this evening. The men in the crowd were in a very talkative mood and asked questions one after another, and then silence seemed to descend upon them. It was John who said, "Master, I think we're all out of questions, and so let's stop and take some time to refresh ourselves." But a man quickly stood up and said, One moment. Jesus said, "Speak." John responded, "I thought we were going to rest and eat." And Jesus turned to John and said, "Patience, my son. Patience." The man who stood up asked, "Master, how will we know when the world will end and when we will be taken to the Father's home where there will be peace and no problems, love, an abundance of food and happiness?" "In that order," another asked. The men began to laugh. Jesus seemed to ignore this comment, thought for a moment, and then said, "I tell you this, when the time comes, man will feel it and know it, but still be blinded to it." They just looked at one another. Jesus continued, "I tell you again, man will be blinded to it. For man will fear losing all the possessions that he has gathered, his freedoms and rights, and those he has loved. But again, I tell you, they will feel it and know it. For the world will be in great turmoil. There will be wars in every land. There will be men with great riches and men who are very hungry and poor. Disease and famine will plague the world, and undesirable rodents will come and eat the grain. Man's soul will be blackened, not only by anger and mistrust, but by sins of lust. I tell you this, from the moment man is born to the moment man dies, there will be much pain. But the pain can turn to joy and love if man changes his ways. Yes, my children, time is like these sands we walk upon. Each grain marks the passage of time. Then he looked down and said, man must pray and change his ways. But there is no stopping the end of time, for all must end one day. When a man is born, he begins to die. It is the same with the earth. A story of faith and imagination. Now I'd like to read in part of an introduction from a book that we're going to be talking about tonight, titled Mid-Faith Crisis, Finding a Path Through Doubt, Disillusionment, and Dead Ends. A meme pops up on social media every now and then, how it started and how it's going. Couples post first date snapshots alongside celebratory wedding pictures. Parents post their newborn baby alongside their college graduate. One astronaut framed an old picture of his childhood self in a cardboard box rocket ship next to a picture of his grown man self-flying a real NASA space shuttle. We depict less celebratory things with this meme, too. Breakups, loss, decline. Things that started strong and fancy, ending weak and laughable. But whichever direction the photos take us, we enjoy the contrast of time passing, change happening. We smile proudly, laugh uncomfortably. It's all so true, so relatable. What would our faith look like in a how it started, how it's going meme? What was our fresh, hopeful picture at the beginning? And how do we look now? For many of us, well, it's not pretty. Whether we begin the faith journey in childhood or adulthood, we started full of earnest faith, hope, and love. But life has proven to be complicated for many of us. Certainly, from what we had at the beginning and couldn't hold up to the challenge. Over time, our religious energy and excitement fizzled. Our prayer muscles atrophied. Our trust was shaken. The songs, books, verses, and even beliefs we once loved vividly remind us of painful losses and disappointments. What happened? Why the stark juxtaposition between how we started out in the faith and how it's going now? Simply put, we hit a crisis or two or three. A mid-faith crisis, you might call it. As you've likely noticed, this is a common tale. And my guests this evening, who are the authors of this book, are Catherine McNeil. She is a chaplain, author, editor, and speaker searching for the creative, redemptive work of God in our ordinary lives. And she lives in Chicagoland area with her husband, three children, and one enormous garden. Catherine holds an MA in Human Service Counseling and is finishing a Master of Divinity at North Park Theological Seminary. Her previous books include Fearing Bravely, All Shall Be Well, and Long Days of Small Nights. And second guest is Jason Haig. He's an associate pastor of Christ Center Church near Eugene, Oregon, and the author of Aching Joy, Following God Through the Land of Unanswered Prayer. Jason has written extensively on the subject of the Christian faith and autism, special needs families, and his own spiritual journey toward hope for his own non-speaking autistic son. And what we're going to tell you a story about that son. His writing has appeared in Christianity Today, Focus on the Family, and Fathom. Catherine and Jason, welcome to Amplify.
Thank you. Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for having us on.
Great to have you. I think I know a little bit about you just from your writing in the book, and so I'm looking forward to this interview. What did each of you hope to accomplish through this book, Mid-Faith Crisis? A lot of that going on.
Well, I'll start with my half of the answer. I feel like for 20 years at least, I've had just conversation after conversation with people who have taken the risk to confide in me, that they have doubts that surprise them. They are having a crisis of faith that they didn't see coming and they don't want. And they hear a lot of people talking about this kind of thing, and they're scared. They want to hold on. They want to find a way through. They love God. They love the church. But they are truly hurting, and they have serious questions and significant problems, and they are just desperately in need of someone who will walk with them. And I wanted to provide a little bit of that voice, a little bit of that mm-hmm. shepherding through this book to say it's real and it's scary, and we do need to be honest about this, but there is a path. There is a path that we can find through.
Jason?
Yeah, I think I've had some similar circumstances, and I even went through a real crisis of faith in my life not so very long ago. And it was as I was sort of exploring that disorientation that I realized, hey, you know, this is there's a lot of people going through stuff like this. And I was able to explore that and, you know, find my way through that whole situation. But I wanted to be there to be able to tell people, look, it's not inevitable. If you're having a crisis of faith, it's not inevitable that you are going to lose your faith. And I mm-hmm. think so often that becomes the minute you have a question or a doubt or something you can't explain, you just jump to that thing of like, well, I guess this is like the beginning of the end. And I wanted to share that that's not the case. There really is hope.
And let me just so I make sure that I get this story in, Jason. Tell us about your son and your awakening to what was really going on with him. It's just an incredible story. What a way to end the book.
Yeah, we're starting with the spoiler. I wrote my first book, Aching Joy, about my relationship with Jack, my autistic son. And we had for years and years, you know, just prayed for a communication breakthrough with him. He's a wonderful kid. And we just, you know, we just kept asking God, because I just want to know my son. I want to know my son. And I sort of come to terms with the fact, I thought, well, he's 17 now, and he's never going to speak, so we're never going to get inside his head like we had hoped. But just a couple of years ago, my wife and I, after seeing the documentary and doing some research, discovered a whole new realm of people, families like ours with non-speaking kids who had a communication breakthrough by teaching their kids to spell on a large letter board. And the theory was that that they're fully in there, you know. Yes. So for us, it was like, Jack, what if Jack is fully in here? What if he fully understands? What if he's not intellectually disabled? And so we began to go after that by training his gross motor, because communication requires fine motor. So we thought, well, let's start with gross motor. If he's unable to control his body, that's really the problem. And so over with months of therapy, months of work with him, he reached a place where he was able to control his body enough to be able to spell by pointing to large letters on the letterboard. And the things he began spelling blew us away. We discovered he had been in there his entire almost 18 years of life. He had been he remembered things. He is very intelligent. He is emotionally very deep. And he has written, you know, he wrote a letter to us when we first had this breakthrough, and it was just a beautiful celebration. So he continues to progress. He wants to He wants to go to college. He wants to study. He told us he wants to study astrophysics someday, you know, and it's been an incredible breakthrough. And the thing that that's spoken to me in regards to what we're talking about today is you can pray for something for a really, really long time, pray for a certain result. And oftentimes we have a specific way we're asking God to move. And sometimes God just surprises you with an answer.
Yes.
And I think it's so important for us to, as we're walking through these depths and these mysteries, that we stay curious as to how God might actually move. It might be different than we expected. This is so much different than we expected. But man, it is a beautiful, beautiful thing for our family and our son.
And just thank you for that. I passed the book around to a lot of people saying you got to read these three pages. But you write there, for the first time in his life, he described to us what was going on inside him, how his body does things out of his control, how the stimuli around him assault his senses, how he has felt trapped inside his own body for the past 17 years, how sweet it was to be able to finally speak, even in this modified form. I could read on. I mean, I could probably take the whole first hour reading from the book from what each of you have written in various parts, but that's the context. And I think it colors everything we're talking about tonight in some sense. So Catherine, what basically is a midlife crisis and what forms can it take?
We love the phrase mid-faith crisis because it's kind of a play on words. You know, we've gotten kind of used to the idea that as we grow up through life, that there's just moments of big transition where we have to sort of renegotiate everything in order to make it to the next season. And we haven't really necessarily given thought to the fact that our faith has similar transition points. And that often those often also come with a lot of upheaval or a lot of difficulty and trouble. Just like adolescence is a time of growing, but it feels really complicated and sometimes painful along the way. Or the way you lose your baby teeth, and it feels and looks pretty awful. You can't eat for a couple weeks, but on the other side of it, you have something that is stronger and longer lasting. You're more equipped for what is to come. And that's kind of how I think of the mid-faith crisis, as something akin to losing your baby teeth or going through a midlife crisis. You are going through a time of upheaval that you don't want. It isn't pretty. It can create and stem from all kinds of true trauma and suffering, but it is coming so that on the other end, you may be better equipped for what is to come. And you said you could read for the whole hour. I could probably talk about faith crisis for the whole hour, too.
Yes, and, sure.
I think for a lot of us, it comes when life just proves to be so full of suffering, we can hardly breathe, and we start asking ourselves, where is God in all of this? How do I even, you know, we use the word disorientation. How do I even find which way is up? For lots of other people, it comes when the church community that we trusted to be the hands and feet of Jesus turn out to do a lot of harm in our lives, or maybe a hero that we were being discipled by or really looked up to as someone who was a hero in the faith turns out to be doing, again, more harm than good. There are so many reasons where everything we thought we knew for sure, we were joyfully, enthusiastically following, all of a sudden it just seems like everything's upside down and we can't find the path through. And as much as no one wants that to happen, what we've found is that it's actually incredibly common, and it can even be healthy, because some of the things that we're renegotiating or reconsidering were never part of Jesus' kingdom or the path of goodness in the first place.
Right. You have a long list of some of the ways of our faith journey has started. Jason, why is it important to reflect on how your faith started and how it's going now?
You just cut out at the end of that question.
Okay.
Can you ask that again?
Why is it important to reflect on how your faith started and how it is going now? Jason, are you still cutting out?
I'm sorry. The connection just cut out. I didn't catch the question.
Okay. Well, let's try one more time. Why is it important to reflect on how your faith started and how it is going now?
Oh, I got you that time. It's so important because we have to frame, we have to frame this for the next generation. We want to be able to present a realistic picture of what the faith looks like. But we also want to be able to chart our own journey to understand, okay, wait, where did I go wrong? Because a lot of times the problem isn't with, the problem isn't with God. The problem isn't with Scripture. Sometimes the problem is with something you were told about God. Sometimes it was really poor theology. Sometimes it was a promise that somebody shouldn't have given you. So it's important to find those things and to, in order to diagnose the real problem.
And let me just point out to people that we didn't touch on that, Jason, you're far away from us, and it's something like this could happen. You might even drop off, as you indicated, and then Catherine would have to do the whole program. So let's just keep going from there, but I just want people to understand what we might be facing in the future here. We are wired to approach faith differently at different times, and one description has used the terms disorientation and disintegration. Which of you would like to talk to that, speak to that?
Jason, you want to take that one?
Let's hold up now. We just have 1 minute. My producer is... suggested to me that I'm not looking at the clock like I should be. But our guests are Catherine McNeil and Jason Haig. We're talking about a book titled Mid-Faith Crisis. And it's something that all of us might expect. And there's different ways to look at it from a positive and from a negative aspect. How it's going, disappointed, fallen heroes, poor treatment by the church is something we may deal with. Disillusionment, broken promises, scandal, hypocrisy, years of suffering, prayers unanswered, and doubt and God feeling distant. So we're going to take this break and we'll be back. Welcome back to Amplify. Speaking about a book titled Mid-Faith Crisis. Two authors are Catherine McNeil and Jason Haig. Jason's a long way off, and if we're having phone problems, he's already said that he'll just drop off and we'll allow Catherine to deal with the rest of the interview. The goal of the book, as they write, is to foist you into a faith crisis if you aren't in one, or to push you out into a bright new reality if you are. We simply want to open a discussion that might help you fill the gap, to be honest about the low places of faith and normalize the idea that this stage of upheaval is common and necessary. And so are we saying, Catherine, that we should be surprised? We should not be surprised that doubt is a fairly universal human experience.
Absolutely.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Ah, DSW, birthplace of the humble brag. Here, the shoes are so good, no one would ever know how little you paid. If you didn't go telling everyone, that is. And with never-ending options for every style, mood, and occasion, all at really great prices, we'll definitely give you something to brag about. So go ahead, stock up on fresh sneakers from your favorite brands. Or try those boots you always secretly knew you could pull off. Find the shoes that get you at prices that get your budget at DSW stores or at DSW.com. Let us surprise you.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
In a world of endless notifications, there could be an important one you're missing. Your kidneys may be signaling an SOS. With high blood pressure or type 2 diabetes, your kidneys could be warning you of early signs of damage, which may put you at higher risk for events like heart attack or stroke. But there's a simple test that can help spot a hidden signal. Ask your doctor about a urine test called UACR to help detect kidney disease and heart risk early. To learn more, visit detectthesos.com today.
You know, Jason was saying before the break that one of the reasons why we want to have this conversation is to help those of us who are in mid-faith crisis get some perspective on what's going on. But it's also to help us create a more truthful, truthful explanation for the generations coming before. So many of us were told, you know, because God is loving, we won't have to suffer very much, or because we can be sure of God, we should never have any doubts. And none of those things are biblical, and none of those things ring true with how humans are wired or how life is. And so we would just love to have people not feel the need to panic if they suddenly start having doubts and questions, because we're confident that God is big enough to handle anything we throw at him, and that there's friends, spiritual friends, that can walk with you through them too. There's nothing we're asking that hasn't been asked by others, and God has stayed faithful for many generations.
Yeah, you put out in the book, we're almost never certain about anything, and yet we go about our lives. Jason, what does it mean to have to reframe our faith?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when we're younger, our faith, you know, we expect it to look a certain way, and we have certain, like, you know, definitions around it. A lot of times that involves sort of parroting back what we grew up in the church we grew up in. And, you know, as we get older, we establish some of those things on our own. But I think in different stages of our lives, we have to be able to look at this and say, wait a minute, are these answers that I had still satisfactory? Is this still true in my life? Because again, some of the things we pick up along the way aren't actually true, or they might feel right at a certain stage of life. When we become new parents, a lot of times we get parenting philosophies and we're like, this is the way to do it. And then when you actually have kids, and then, you know, you have different experiences, or you might be like me, you have a child with disabilities, and you realize, wait a minute, I have to throw out the playbook. I have to start again. I think we have to reframe our faith in that same way to sort of reevaluate, is this right? Did I think about this right? Were my answers solid enough for this stage in my life? Or do I need to plunge a little bit deeper, because the faith is big and our faith is very old? And believers throughout the centuries have lots of ways to think about our faith. So for me, it's about coming back. It's about coming back and asking those questions again, and trying to find maybe maybe more solid answers to the questions than we had before.
As right in the book, faith is not something unbelievable we're trying hard to convince ourselves of, but convictions in which we invest our time and energy. Faith is a destination mixed up with our dreams and hopes and desires, one that we would give our lives to, perhaps even our deaths. It's a vision of God's love, acceptance, and justice for the world, for ourselves. It might be hard to believe that God is good some days, that God is love. And that's okay. It's okay if your faith feels small right now. All you need to have is a mustard seed. All you need to do is lay it on the ground and trust it will grow. This is the practice of faith. Catherine, tell us, there's a chapter that speaks about how your faith was harmed by the church.
Yeah, I grew up as a pastor's daughter, which I really loved. The church that my dad was pastoring, I was just 3 or 4 years old when we moved to this community, so I didn't really remember anything else. I felt that this community and this church was the whole world, and we lived far away from my actual grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins, so the church really, to a great degree, felt like my grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins, and of course, that's how the church is meant to be that kind of community. But when I was just about 12 years old, my family was very abruptly sent out of the church and very entirely. I won't get into all of the details or all the reasons. We do write about it more in the book, yes. Mid-Faith Crisis. But suffice to say, basically on a dime, everyone just turned their back on us entirely to the degree that I wasn't invited to come to school. The school was in the church building, or to come to church. And we had to be out of town, out of the house, out of everything in about a 2 week period. And very, very few people stayed in touch with us going forward. So it was a time for my family of incredible disastrous upheaval and loss and rejection and abandonment, with ripples that were financial and health and career and relationship. But what I'm particularly writing about in the book was the impact that it had on me to have basically everyone I knew in the world, people that I genuinely believed loved me, and the people who had taught me how to find God, the people that I worshiped with, the people who had pointed the way of the Christian faith, just absolutely reject and exile and abandon me so quickly and suddenly and so completely. So that is the mid-faith crisis that I primarily write about in this book. Jason's is different. But that, to say that that has sent me on a journey of many decades of asking questions and wrestling with trust and with who God is and what the church is and how we find God in the midst of suffering and how we open our hearts to love and be loved and to know and be known. That's an understatement. I have been wrestling with these questions of faith crisis for a long time, but, and again, not to give a spoiler, I have not found redemption to come quickly or easily, but I have, again, we're talking decades, you know, four decades. I have found God to have been with me through all of it. I didn't see that at the time, but I do see now that God was with me even in the darkest valley.
Right, and put out in the book that the church fails when pastors and it's others too, in as the book goes on, abuse authority. There are a lot of ways in which that can happen.
Yeah.
But you also point out that Jesus had plenty of direct words to say to religious leaders who abused their power and harmed their sheep, didn't he?
Yes. That's something that has really stuck with me through the writing of this book, Mid-Faith Crisis, is that we are so often concerned to protect the people who are holding power or the people whose reputation is what is leading the organization or the church. But throughout the Bible, in the prophets and in the Gospels, Jesus and God and the writers of Scripture are saying over and over and over again that he is on the side of the brokenhearted. He is the one who is the good shepherd. He is going after the lost, wandering sheep. And that's where we're going to find Jesus. And that there are quite a few shepherds who are actually wolves. And God does not have any kind words for those who are devouring the earnest followers of Jesus rather than providing for and protecting them. And that has been a very healing component of writing this book, is reflecting on these words over and over and over again, that Jesus is the good shepherd who is looking for the one who is lost and abandoned and is absolutely not going to be siding with the false teachers, the false shepherds, who are abandoning and devouring the sheep.
Jason, tell us a little bit about your story under the chapter, When Our Heroes Fell.
Yeah. This is a sobering one. For me, the scandal that rocked me was the Ravi Zacharias scandal. And he had been a major influence in my life and in my early ministry. The way he communicated, the way he thought, there were so many things that I looked up to. And I thought, man, I don't have all the answers, but people like Ravi are around, and I'm sure they have the answers, and they would say it really well. And so when all the news broke of how he had, you know, been living this double life, not just a single slip up, but an intentional pattern of abusing women all over the world in really egregious ways, I was gutted. I thought, you've got to be kidding me. It didn't send me, over the edge in my faith. I was, I held on, but it was such a quick disillusionment that happened. Because then you start wondering, is anybody real? Mm-hmm. Are any of these supposed men of God actually men of God? And are we all then just in danger of immediately our lives all falling apart? It was a pretty rough month that month. It was deeply sad.
And let me just read this from that chapter. It's just a little bit longer, but it'll cover a lot of questions that I don't have to ask. Then Jesus came in the very nature of God, yet not considering that his status, something had to be grasped, something to hold on to. Instead, Jesus made himself nothing, a servant, eschewing riches and slipping away from crowds. God laid down his life for us. He came not as a prince of the Roman Empire, or even a citizen, but as a not entirely legitimate baby in a peasant family of an occupied nation. He hung out with the working poor, the diseased, the ones with few earthly options. He healed people in shadows, hid from the paparazzi, and railed against the deceitfulness of wealth. He never wrote a book or left anything behind, but the symbols of his own broken body and blood. He ate with the sinners in their homes while angrily confronting the quote-unquote good religious leaders for doing so much damage to the people under their influence. And so they made many people feel betrayed. And you point out that perhaps that midlife crisis was felt by thousands of people in that way.
Yeah.
And so instead of looking for heroes, it may be a time to look for those around us who are worthy of praise. I don't know which of you wrote that.
We both kind of wrote everything. It's kind of hard to remember who initially wrote
that.
But Catherine has written, I think she took the lead in this part, about looking to others. So maybe you should talk about that, Kathy.
Yeah, this is something I have, like I've said, I've spent a lifetime reflecting on this, and I have written about it elsewhere as well, that it's interesting how even in faith, we know the Sermon on the Mount, we know the Beatitudes, we know Philippians chapter 2, where we're being reminded over and over again that it's not wealth and power where we find God. It's in justice and mercy and compassion and humility. It's in laying down our lives. That's what Jesus did. It's not in overpowering. So I just keep encouraging myself, first of all, and then others, not to look for the people who are growing in power as our models for what it looks like to be Jesus in this world, but the people who are almost forgotten. You know, who is it that's cleaning the bathrooms after everyone has left? Who is it that's taking out the garbage? Who is it that's sitting on the floor with the kids in the hallway, or who's making sure everyone has enough to eat? I think that's where we're going to find the models that we need, both to be formed ourselves into the Christ-likeness, but also in how we approach the world and how we serve, how we reflect Christ to our neighbors. But we forget to look there. It's so mm-hmm. easy to look at the people who are on television or on the internet and think, wow, they must be the people I should follow.
Yes. Jason, how can one's prayer life be affected? And then you write about prayer warriors.
Yeah. Yeah, in a lot of circles, I'm Protestant, and I come from a charismatic Pentecostal type background, and in our circles, a lot of times people get very zealous in their prayer life, which can be good, but they often take it to a place of almost telling God what to do a lot of times, mm-hmm. and feeling like everything is on them in their prayer. So if I don't pray this specific thing or this specific way, then everything's going to fall apart. And I think, in this phase of my life and in reflecting on this these last several years, I've come to realize I think that can be a really damaging way to engage in prayer. Now, even if God is asking us here, bring your requests, ask, that's good. But Jesus also taught us to pray, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. And I think it's so important to pray with open hands instead of clenched fists, grabbing onto that outcome that we desperately want. So over time, my prayer life has changed significantly. There's a lot less words in my prayer life now, a lot less words. Mm-hmm. There's a lot less advice. I'm not giving advice to God anymore. I'm learning to revel in silence and to sit in his presence and trust that he knows what's best.
And so you point out that prayer can become all about how persuasive we can be at getting God to do what we want. It's not what it is it?
No, not in my reading of Scripture. That's not what it is. It's, man, if we truly believe God is our Father, then we are the kids in this scenario. We're the kids. We're not the ones with all the information. And again, we're invited to bring our requests, but we don't have to twist God's arm, I think, in inviting God's presence. Well, that's not necessary. I don't think that's what Jesus wants from us.
In one of the ways that you explained that, you said you write, once that pow of unanswered prayer gets high enough, you realize prayer can't be about using your words to make God do your bidding.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there are a lot of ways in which we think that could be true, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think so much of that, again, I think that's one of those places that not every tradition has this same kind of problem. But where I come from, my circles, it's just this habitual thing, I think, that's been handed down, that prayer involves a lot of words. You change your voice a little bit, and you want to sound authoritative, and you want to sound really sure of yourself and sound powerful in the way that you pray. And the lesson that we have learned in all of that is I have to be impressive. I have to be convincing. I have to be certain. I have to sound like somebody, you know, that God would want to listen to, somebody worthy of being listened to. And I don't think there's a whole lot of trust in that posture.
And as you write in the prayer warrior sections, what a strange delusion of power. We treated the fate of our fellow humans as if they depended not on a loving creator, but on our midnight pleas, as though our lives were rooted not in God's care, but in the performance of prayer warriors. Looking back, I'm convinced we were not wasting our time. Jesus invites us to bring our petitions to God. God tells us to ask for help, but God also tells us to trust, to be still, to be thankful, to rest, to meditate, to contemplate, to dwell, to bring God our groanings too deep for words. Amplify on that a little bit, especially the last part. To bring God our groanings too deep for words.
Yeah, sometimes when the pain is so great, I think it's good to just come to him and just let it all out. And sometimes we don't know how to put our grief or our fears into words at all. But to trust that God's not going to throw us out, he's not going to turn us out, he's not going to strike us with lightning if we bring those deep pains to him. In fact, that's what he's invited us to do.
The prayer can become all about how persuasive we can be at getting God to do what we want. So what happened to all those prayers I prayed in my 20s and 30s? What happened to yours, the ones that didn't get approved through the bureaucracy of heaven? Did they ever receive a hearing? Did they accidentally get deleted from God's hard drive? Or did God simply say no? That's one way which you approach it.
Yeah.
And so it's not.
Yeah. And we don't have the answers to those, you know?
Right, exactly. So, and it's not that we don't believe anymore, you write. It's just that our words feel so empty, like expired coupons that were never a good deal to begin with. Once that pile of unanswered prayer gets high enough, you realize prayer can't be about using your words to make God do your bidding. That doesn't mean we shouldn't pray, but it's all comes down to our understanding of what prayer is. So we're coming up on our next break, and so I won't ask any more questions. So we'll be back after this break. Welcome back to Amplify, where we're speaking about a book, Mid-Faith Crisis. Our guests are the authors, Catherine McNeil and Jason Haig. Subtitle is Finding a Path Through Doubt, Disillusionment, and Dead Ends as You Think About Perhaps Your Prayer. And on, Catherine, on page 97, you say you recently found the words from your journal from your early days of parenthood, which led you to believe that maybe this is the best way to understand prayer. Help us to...
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. TNCs apply. In app only.
come to DSW for the shoes, stay for the fun. Because let's be honest, if shoe shopping isn't fun, are you even doing it right? So go ahead, try something new. Try something different. Good different. Try something that feels like you. You know, the real you. And then definitely brag about it later. Because at DSW, you've got unlimited freedom to play. Find the shoes that get you at prices that get your budget at DSW stores or at DSW.com. Let us surprise you.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
You're jamming your favorite song, and while you aren't missing a beat, you could be missing a signal from your body. It's an SOS from your kidneys, and it doesn't sound like music at all. It's silent. High blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and other risk factors can quietly stress the kidneys, leading to negative impacts on the heart. That's why you should ask your doctor about a simple urine test called UACR. Most miss the signal for hidden kidney disease and related heart risk. You shouldn't. Visit detecttheSOS.com today to learn more.
Understand that.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that, actually, because right before the break, when you and Jason were talking about maybe ways that we used words in prayer, we thought we were doing prayer the way we had been told or the way God wanted, but with reflection, we realize it's strangely as though we're telling God what to do or advising God as though he were dispassionate, you know, just someone who is looking for the opinion poll to make a decision rather than the good and loving father that he is. And I think you asked Jason, what is a better way? Like, what are our prayers for then? And I don't know the answer to that question, but mm-hmm. I do think about those days when I had my little babies and they would just gaze into my eyes and they would make so much noise and wave their arms and legs around. And we were having an amazing time connecting and getting to know each other and building trust and affection. And that I hope will last a lifetime. But they didn't know what I was saying, and I didn't know what they were saying. But it basically came down to, I care about you. I'm going to take care of you. I love you. You can trust me. That's what came across somehow. You know, our babies learn that we will be the ones to keep them warm and well-fed, and they respond with these amazing sounds that have no meaning in any known language, but it is building a connection. And I think that after, again, decades of pouring out our hearts to God, letting God know, even telling God what to do or giving him advice he hasn't asked for, whatever missteps we may have taken in prayer, I don't think God is holding it against us or, you know, giving us a grade. I think it's all just the noise that we are making as we are being held and cared for and loved. And it's creating trust and intimacy, even if the words themselves don't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, you point out that none of us know enough to really comprehend prayer. Our most eloquent, theologically, purely motivated prayers aren't much more than babbling to an infinite creator. But God cares for us, loves us, stays close to us, even when we can't or won't pursue a relationship with him. So how much sweeter when we do, even if halting, unbalanced, confused, and self-centeredly. And then you write a little bit further, I'm learning to embrace prayer now. Like Jack, I run out of words and sometimes find them frustrating. Language is one of God's greatest gifts, to be sure, but there's something else that comes first. Presence. Presence, and we're talking about here, P-R-E-S-E-N-C-E, presence comes before language. Presence is the foundation of our relationship and the true essence of prayer. Say a little bit more about the importance of presence.
Yeah, that was a section I wrote when I had, you know, kind of an epiphany of how meaningful it is just to be with my son, even if he doesn't have any words at all. And that was before he had this breakthrough. But it was a powerful thing for me to reflect on, that God is with us before there's any words, you know. And that's the abiding promise throughout Scripture. I will be with you. I will be with you over and over again in a thousand different ways, is the promise of God's presence. And I'm grateful for words. I'm grateful that we can pray with words, that we can write books with words, that we can sing songs. But before any of that is just being with God, and God has promised to be with us.
And another way in which you say that in writing, being open and vulnerable with God about our fears, needs, hopes, and feelings, excited or brokenhearted or anything in between, is very different from telling God what to do. Presence is the foundation of our relationship and true essence of prayer. We don't need to boss God around or give orders. We don't need to beg or plead, but we're invited to trust, to rest, to pour out our hearts and draw near. So God is worth knowing, even though he doesn't obey my instructions. I don't know who wants to pick up on that.
I can. I think this is I remember writing that sentence and thinking, you know, how audacious even to say this, you know, that God is worth knowing even if he doesn't do what I ask him or tell him to do, even though he doesn't obey me. And even though that sounds so audacious when we say it that way, isn't that how so many of us feel? Or what is actually kind of at the root of so much of our discontent is that we start to doubt God's goodness simply because God has not done what we said that God should do. And I think that is a good example of what we mean by mid-faith crisis. Because normally when we're in a position where we are feeling this, it's because we are heartbroken. We are truly suffering. We are truly devastated. And we are hoping that there is some solace. There's something solid and trustworthy somewhere. And it isn't prayer itself that is broken. It's the way we were taught to view prayer, or how we were taught to understand what it was for many of us, not for all of us, but for Jason and I, at least, and for a lot of people that we have talked to either before and after writing this book. So what if we looked at prayer as something different, like you've been saying, a chance to connect with the God who is here to comfort us, the God who is here with his presence, here to be worshiped and here to walk with us through our lives. But with the caveat that he's not going to obey us, but we are invited to follow him and to draw near.
Yeah, I can amplify on that by reading from your book, God is worth knowing, even though he doesn't obey my instructions. It's worth spending time with God, worth practicing how to live in God's presence, even though we can't control what God does, even though we know God won't make all our dreams come true or remove our pain. Prayer is a way of imbibing courage and strength to continue this long, hard journey of life by being with someone who knows and loves us perfectly from beginning to end. Prayer is an awkwardly broad term, or at least a dozen spiritual practices, each with a rich history. Maybe Jesus' prayers in the garden and Jesus' prayers on the cross are the examples we need in this mid-faith season of suffering and doubt. Jason?
Yeah. I think it's when we get to these places, we have to just look forward and say, okay, this hasn't served me. So what is it now? You know, how do I connect with God right here where I am today? And if that means finding a new angle and finding a new practice, prayer is where a lot of this starts. So figuring out, you know, what can I draw from? What, what great, you know, men and women of faith throughout the ages can I draw from here? Maybe I just need to zoom out a little bit and expand my palette of what works, what the things that I try, the ways that I pray, all of those things. We have such richness in throughout church history, and so let's zoom out from the familiar when we get stuck.
I love the conclusion of this particular part. You recall Jesus' final words, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And then, right, but if prayer was enough for Jesus at his darkest hours, it is good enough for us in ours. God, here I am, so tired, so worn out, far too exhausted to hold on to hope, with all this pain and sorrow still here. I put myself into your hands. That's a prayer we can honestly repeat every day, isn't it?
That's another section that I remember writing really clearly. That kind of came to me while I was at a funeral that was very grievous for me. And just reading the words of Jesus, his final words, saying, "Into your hands I commit my spirit." There's a lot of things I would love to be true about the life of faith, but this feels like the one kind of the most rooted thing I can hold on to no matter what, is that I'm choosing to commit my spirit to God, choosing to believe that God is worthy of everything. And if that was good enough for Jesus, like we said in the book, then I'm going to give it a try.
And you have, I know this is your chapter, at least at the beginning, you write, for many, many, life is suffering with occasional interruptions of joy that fade all too quickly before returning to the main story of anguish. In our modern life and modern faith, we are necessarily taught to expect this or trained to prepare for it. Amplify on that a little bit.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing that Jason and I discussed a lot as we were researching for this book and reflecting on the mid-faith crises that we've had and that the people around us have had. And I think a lot of it is that for so much of human history, there was so much suffering that any respite, any oasis was just felt like a miracle. But everyone knew that it was coming back around. There was famine, there was death, there was war. And it wasn't out there somewhere in the news. It was right here. It was right in our families and in our tribes. And I think we have kind of bought into a version of the American dream that says we have fixed a lot of that. Like, it's now people over there far from us who are experiencing those things, and we for some reason deserve or have earned a much easier time. And so when just the realities, and to be clear, that's not even remotely accurate or true, and it's certainly not biblical or part of the Christian faith. But I think when just the normal realities of life, of illness and suffering and pain and death and relational pain and just so many of the things that we all encounter, when those hit us, we aren't prepared somehow. We are shocked as though something strange were happening. And then we ask, God, why is it this way? And I think that is the question, you know, Job was asking that question. So it's the most ancient question of all. But for some reason, I feel like we have not been taught to look to the great cloud of witnesses who have survived life before us to help us through. And that's one of the things that we wanted to bring out in that chapter, is how suffering, unfortunately, is a part of life. And many, many, many people have found that God has been their anchor in suffering, not their magic wand to get out of it, but the anchor that helps them to get through.
As you point out in your book, that Jesus promised that we would have suffering, and that we grow by pursuing wisdom and humility, by learning to sit comfortably with mystery. Who wants to jump on that?
Yeah, I think, I'll jump on that. I think that, we can try to wrap our minds around all kinds of things that we're going through. We can have all kinds of answers for the problem of evil that great, theologians have posed throughout the centuries. But at some point, there is no answer. And we just have to acknowledge that. It is, at some point, there's no satisfying answer as to why there's such suffering, to why there's disease and war and famine and all these things. And orthodoxy, I'm all for finding good orthodox answers and finding these things, but you can't explain your pain away from your experience. And so ultimately we have to reach that place when we say, this is mystery and I don't know what to do with this, but I'm going to keep walking. So we have to invite mystery into our experience.
And part of one of the chapters in talking about suffering is surviving grief. How can we survive grief?
Well, I told the story in that chapter of losing a very dear friend who was like a sister to me and like an auntie to my kids, and losing her to cancer at a young age was devastating. And so that was the thing that led me into my crisis of faith, ultimately. And learning to take that grief before the Lord and being willing to really lament, truly to learn to lament like the psalmist did, like Jeremiah did, like so many of these people did, just learning to take all that pain and all the questions and might be anger before the Lord and to cast our burdens on the Lord was such an instrumental way to live with that grief, to not try to cover it up, but to say, here, I don't understand this. I don't understand why she's gone. I don't understand. Well, you have the power. You could have done something. You didn't. It's like God knows when those questions are in our hearts anyway. So there's no sense in covering them up. It's kind of a silly thing. So walking through grief, I think it is essential that we deal with our grief honestly before God and actually bring that stuff directly into our prayer.
So as we get closer to the end, I'm moving a little bit deeper into the book, and with many beautiful thoughts that I have highlighted, and you write that we grow by pursuing wisdom and humility, by learning to sit comfortably with mystery. We're not even asked to defend or prove God's existence by rightness, for Jesus said that the proof would be in our love. The invitation before us is to walk away from formula, narratives, and into a more robust, mature story. We are infants in God's arms, and He has never asked us to transcend our mortal limits and attain omniscience or perfections, has He?
No, He hasn't. He hasn't. I think He's invited us to bring our whole human experience to Him.
And in fact, the position that one would think is obvious, but needs to be said, Catherine, we are loved with an everlasting love, aren't we?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, and getting at your earlier point also, for some reason, if you anywhere you go, anything you turn on or start reading, you'll find Christians arguing, accusing each other, saying egregious and hateful things about each other because we're locked in this kind of true-false test that we're arguing about who's right and who's wrong. But it's interesting that Jesus never says that we are saved by being right. He demonstrated and taught over and over again that it is receiving God's love, it is loving God in response, it is loving our neighbors as ourselves, It is receiving love from our neighbors. It's in this lifestyle of love that we find God, and it's in this love that we are saved and that we can find a path forward, even a path out of mid-faith crisis. It is learning to rest in this love and to invite others to rest there also.
And I'm not always sure who's writing what or where indeed this it's under you, Catherine, this particular section. We've already looked at the myth of faith as a shield against suffering, illness, and death. But there's a second layer, a more vulnerable layer, our longing to feel that everything is okay, that we're okay. We trusted that God was on our side always, that we would always feel him there. We would suffer in this life, but with Jesus, we had everything we needed to make it through. How important it is to believe that, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of times we have mistaken our emotional climate for the Holy Spirit, so that if we're feeling upbeat and happy, then God must be near. And if we're feeling sad or afraid or anxious, then God must be far. But fortunately, my emotions are not a barometer for God's faithfulness or God's presence or whether or not God loves me and is sticking with me and has grace for me. Fortunately, those things are sure. And even in our despair and our doubts and our suffering, we can just rest knowing that God is always here.
And to amplify on those very thoughts, you're right. If we build our faith on spiritual euphoria and hope for a rock-solid sense of well-being, the walls crumble quickly. Why is that?
Well, I think because we are human, and we do have all of the lived experience of any human person. There's a song that I learned in my childhood that we wrote about briefly in that chapter that used a lot of really colorful, upbeat, childish images, like all children's songs do, to essentially say that once Jesus is in your life, you will be happy all the time. And kind of like we were saying about prayer, I don't know that any of us really believe that. But we do, I think, hold hope that that might be the case. And it definitely is a promise that many of us were told in our early stages of faith, that if we really love God, we will always have this sense of joy that is available to us. But the fact of the matter is, we are humans in human bodies, in human relationships, in human communities that is experiencing hunger and exhaustion and conflict and sickness. And we're going to have the gamut of emotions. We're not going to be happy and joyful all the time, but we do believe that, yes, God is present with us always.
Right. We're going to be taking our next break, but you point to the struggles of people like Mother Teresa and St. John of the Cross and what they had. So we can expect to have ours. Take this break.
Yes.
Welcome back to our final segment with Catherine McNeil and Jason Haig, the book they've written, Mid-Faith Crisis, Finding a Path Through Doubt, Disillusionment, and Dead Ends. And I'm not quite sure which of the two of you I should be asking this question to, but what is consolation and destillation? You've identified them as movements of the soul.
I think that's a good one for Jason.
Yeah. Consolation and desolation. Those those terms have gone back in history of the church and in all forms of spirituality. But we look at those as movements toward connection and relationship with God, and movements away. And we can have seasons where our experiences, seem to push us in a direction that we feel like we're moving away from God, but we're not. It's just we're drifting in that experiential realm where we feel alone and we feel panicked. And what we're urging people to do, just like the overall premise of the book, is to understand there are seasons where this happens. There are seasons where we're going to feel isolated. There are seasons when we're going to want to run from the things that actually make us safe, run from the things that actually keep us grounded. And to just to be aware that that is the case. So to begin even to embrace, okay, I might be in this dry season, the season of desolation, and to know, hey, this isn't a reason to panic. There, in fact, there might be some beautiful things to glean in this season. You know, there might be beautiful treasures for us in our own spiritual walk that we can discover here. To be aware, listen, there's going to be seasons of hope again. There will be seasons of consolation. There will be seasons when God is drawing us back toward his heart, toward community, toward connection.
And in that particular frame, you write that your emotional or spiritual low points may not signify God's absence or your failure at all. They may be part of the ups and downs of life, signs that your spirit is preparing for a time of growth and fulfillment as the dormancy of winter readies the ground for spring. Not only is desolation and the faith crisis that goes with it not a sure sign of the death of your faith, but it may lead you slowly but surely to consolation. A little bit later, that God is present when we cannot see or feel him, even during the darkest nights within our deepest crises of faith. And when that happens, what do we do?
When that happens, we lean in, we cry out, we don't deny where we are. It's so easy to try to get out of it, to desperately seek evacuation from that place. It's easy sometimes to over-spiritualize it and to say, well, this must be this and this. And, you know, whatever it is, we need to lean in to that thing, to have that full human experience. And once again, to bring it to the presence of God. And I'll say this, almost all of us, I think we tend to grow in those hard times. It's very rare that you get in a time when you're like, man, this is amazing. I'm, you know, my prayers are being answered. Life is so easy and good. And to see a time where you're actually really growing. I think most of the time it's in the midst of those dark seasons that we find immense new sources of comfort and strength.
And Jason, how can we sense God in our inner being?
Wow. Yeah, that's a wonderful question. I think the truth is sometimes we might not be able to. Mm. And that's the hard thing to grapple with. You know, sometimes we have the promise of God's abiding presence. We don't have the promise that we're always going to feel God's abiding presence. And I think those dark times are great opportunities to bring those raw feelings and that raw experience into the presence of God and to ask for that new measure of grace, to ask that we can feel his presence again, to truly know in our bones that we're not alone. But there really are seasons sometimes when God, it feels like God is silent and it feels like God is far away. That's not the case, but those are seasons when we just have to trust and keep on trusting and keep on walking on the journey and refuse to give up, even though we have the absence of that feeling.
Jason, you write that I have learned to let other people into my life, for the spiritual life is indeed a wilderness journey, and we will not survive it on our own. We need wise friends, honest and authentic traveling companions who can nudge us back to health and point out ways God may be speaking to us out of darkness. Amplify on that, if you would, please.
Yeah. You know, I think so often we can treat the spiritual journey as if it's an individual journey. And again, this is, I think, a problem that a lot of evangelicals have and a lot of in the charismatic Pentecostal movement, that the spiritual life, this is about me connecting with God individually. And that is simply not the case. We are, our faith is a communal faith. And we're simply not strong enough to carry the difficulties we have, the questions we have, We're not built for that. We are built for connection. We're built for community. And the sooner we can get comfortable with that and to open up our hearts and let people walk alongside us in the journey, the more we're going to be capable of withstanding these long seasons of desolation. And the more fully we'll be able to rejoice in seasons of consolation.
And you wanted in the book to introduce the practice of spiritual direction.
Yeah. This has been, honestly, I know this has been in the Catholic tradition for many centuries and in other high church settings. In my setting, this is something I hadn't even heard about until maybe 10 years ago. But I started meeting with a spiritual director and someone who just became a sort of soul companion. And I go and I sit with him and I talk with him just like people do with a therapist. And he's very good at listening for in my language of where, you know, where is God, where might God be speaking to me in my experiences and in the things that I'm pulling out. And so he's walked with me through some very, very difficult times. And I can honestly say, I don't know if my faith would have survived if it wasn't for him.
And you point that out. You write that the spiritual life is indeed a wilderness journey, and we will not survive it on our own. We need wise friends, honest, authentic traveling companions who can nudge us back to health and point out ways God may be speaking to us out of darkness. I have several people in my life who know me intimately. They know my longings and my brokenness, my deepest prayers, my worst corruptions, and yet they still love me. They help me see things I didn't see before. I know I'm not alone. Christ is with me, even if I can only feel his presence through my companions. Could you give us an example or two of that?
Yeah, I think, you know, the scripture tells us when two or three are gathered, there I'll be in the midst of them. And I think that's so easy to overlook that concept because we're looking for, if we're looking for some, you know, mystical, just me and God sort of thing. I've developed such deep connections with these people in my life that I can bring them. In fact, in the writing of this book, I brought the chapter when I wrote about losing Janae to two of my dearest friends who also knew her. And we sat around the fire with my wife and just read that chapter and just wept. We just wept together and remembering our friend. And they helped me to sort of carry that in the midst of the release of this book. So that would be one example.
Catherine, what have you learned as a hospital chaplain? You write about that in the book.
Oh, my. I've learned so many things. I think one thing that I write about in the book is how whatever it is that we have survived, there are some things that we need deeply at the end or when we're in the deepest phase of our crisis. We need to know that we're not alone, that there are people who love us that we can look to. We need to know that they're not alone, that even if we're not able to care for them, there are other people who will catch them. I think at the bottom of everything, it's these connections that we've built of trust and of affection that carry us through. And I've learned about myself and how God has brought redemption to me through my mid-faith crisis. You know, we kind of started at the end and now we're in this interview or this conversation, we're kind of winding up here again. Both Jason and I touched on this earlier on, but throughout all of the years, 40-something years of doubting and questioning and wrestling over the true and sometimes severe suffering that we have received or experienced, we have ultimately found that we were not alone and that God has been with us. There have been people of peace who came around us, even if it wasn't in the moment where we needed them. And I've found that
in being broken in all the ways I've been broken and finding healing, I've developed compassion. And I think one of the things I love about my work in the hospital is just watching this cycle happen again and again of people who are in crisis, in need of compassion, surrounded by people of compassion who themselves have been broken and healed. And I think that is the ultimate goal of so much of life, is to survive and gain something beautiful along the way that we can pass on to someone else.
Right. You write what you've learned. Death is stubborn, unrelenting, but so is life. In the most unconducive environment, life fights to survive, and so do I, and so do you. And you point out that I can look back now and see that in my suffering, God met me. Can you give us an example?
Yeah. Again, I don't know, listener, if you were here when I was talking about my childhood and the abandonment and pain that I experienced there. But, I cannot say that there's a silver lining or that there are ways that I felt, poured into at that time. At the time, it just felt like suffering and darkness. And so often our crises are that way. Pain is excruciating and evil is real and life can be very difficult. But looking back, I have become convinced that God is planting seeds of strength and faithfulness and beauty, even on those hardest times. I'm a huge gardener, and one of my favorite components of gardening is compost. And that sounds maybe funny at first, but we keep all of our, the tops of our carrots and the pits of our apples and our coffee grounds and our rotting leftovers. We take it all and we put it in our compost pile, and it is literally a pile of rotting death. It is everything that was alive this year that is now decaying. It is moldy. It smells terrible. It looks even worse. But an amazing thing happens. After a year or two of sitting in this pile, we start to dig through it and we find that it is the most nutrient-filled, ready womb of new life. And it's when we spread this compost, this new soil on our gardens, that beautiful, wonderful things begin to grow. And all that it is the death from what was before. And that is how God works in the world. That is how God has worked in my own life. It's how God is working in our garden. It's how God works from generation to generation, that even when all we have to bring him is pain and suffering and death, somehow, and again, not 15 minutes later, not 15 days later, often after an excruciatingly long season, there is something beautiful and living and good and strong that God has made from that death.
I can amplify on your words in the book. I have a better sense of what is valuable and worth pursuing. I'm committed to search for beauty, rest in mystery, chase after love, to admit the goodness of God is running after me, to take a deep, deep breath of God's presence, of everlasting love, of a goodness that existed long before I was born, that will transcend long after I am gone and forgotten. If we let ourselves, this goodness stems not from leisure and ease, but from hard work and persistence, from all that is real and true in life, good and bad. Jason, tell us about the beauty and power of the 23rd Psalm that you use in your life, the ancient poem that you believe is our story.
Yeah, I think the reason why the 23rd Psalm is why it's quoted in church sanctuaries, why it's on pictures in the nursery, and why it's at every single funeral is that it touches like the entire journey of faith that we have. You know, we follow the shepherd, and there are beautiful seasons where there's green pastures, there's plenty of still water, there's, you know, all of the seasons of consolation are there. And then we also have seasons where we walk through the valley of the shadow, and we learn over time to not fear, but to even celebrate, even feast in the presence of the things that would do us harm. And in the end, we know we'll be in the house of the Lord forever while his goodness follows us. I think it just tells the story of who we are. Mm-hmm. And the most beautiful part of that is the goodness of God, just continuing to pursue us, to follow us all the days of our lives, in the midst of every single season, the beautiful ones and the really difficult ones. I think that's why the psalm resonates with everybody.
And Catherine, you could have used those exact same words yourself when you talk about your call to attend patients awaiting death. And you hear the refrain echoed again and again, did I love well? Was I a good spouse, a good parent, a good friend? And yet you believe it's the hardships we endure, the experience of walking all the way through deep, dark valleys and coming out the other side and finding we are not alone, have never, ever been alone. It is in giving and receiving faithful, steadfast love and mercy. Expand on that just a little bit.
Yeah, it's hard to improve on the words that we wrote so carefully, but I'm so glad to hear them read back, because I do believe that's true. And, you know, all of us want our lives to be straightforward and simple and full of joys and gifts, and we don't want the pain. And again, you know, Jason and I have both personally and in our role of walking alongside others seen just how painful life can be. And we don't want to shy away from that. But we're also convinced that it isn't in the ease and the simple challenges where we grow the fulfillment and the depth of wisdom and of joy and of ability to see God, that it is often in the long perseverance of survival, the wrestling, the lamenting, the holding on to others. Somehow there's something in that process that after a long period of time does grow something that is fulfilling and rich in our lives.
Another way in which you write about that, it is the hardships we endure together, the experience of walking all the way through deep, dark valleys and coming out the other side and finding we are not alone. And this is where we hope to end up, surrounded by love and goodness all the days of our lives. But for now, all that is required of us is to not give up, to keep on going, even in the darkest valley. How? By looking forward in trust that the Lord is our shepherd, the indescribable wonder of love. Our guests have been Catherine McNeil and Jason Haig. The book is Mid-Faith Crisis. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Wonderful. All right. Blessings to you.
God bless you.
You too.
Bye now. So we come to the end of the program, and just some final words from the book. What if we embrace this gift of curiosity in the midst of our crisis? What if we became like children again, not demanding specific outcomes, but believing that this big God we follow might yet amaze us somehow? After all, if Christ can turn water to wine, surely he can turn some of our ashes into beauty. Surely he can surprise us once in a while. Curiosity is not and never will be an antidote to pain, but I have found it to be a balm. For while we walk through hardship, the God of the unexpected walks with us. That means there will be beautiful surprises right next to the hard ones. I've seen it with my own eyes in my beloved son, Jack, and that's the story we told at the beginning of the program. Jack sat down with us one morning, and we held up letterboard and asked him how he felt. He told us, "I am filled with hope. The very big things I spent years asking God for did not materialize in the ways I asked or expected. But surely God heard my cry and answered me. Now greatness hasn't found me, and I no longer expect or even hope that it will, because surely God's goodness has." Now forget then how precious life is and how powerful love is. Tell someone now that you love him or her. Pray for peace as if it depended on you alone, and come back next Sunday and amplify with us.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
I'm caught up in the game. My attention is on every play and every whistle. But what I'm missing is a signal coming from my kidneys. That signal isn't like a ref's whistle. It's more of a silent SOS, which could be warning me of an increased risk for events like heart attack or stroke. And a way I can catch that signal? A simple urine test called UACR. If you have type 2 diabetes or high blood pressure, talk to your doctor about the UACR test. Detect the SOS. Visit detectthesos.com to learn more.
Did you know your credit card points and miles can lose value to inflation? Credit card companies often reduce the redemption value of your points and miles. Now, imagine a credit card with rewards that can grow in value. With the Gemini credit card, you can earn Bitcoin or one of over 50 other cryptos instantly with no annual fee. Every swipe at the store or gas pump earns you instant rewards deposited straight to your account. Plus, sign up now for a $200 Bitcoin bonus to kickstart your rewards. Visit Gemini.com/card today. Check out the link in the description for more information on rates and fees. Again, if you're looking to invest in Bitcoin but don't know where to start, the Gemini credit card makes it easy.
The Gemini credit card is issued by WebBank. In order to qualify for the $200 crypto intro bonus, you must spend $3,000 in your first 90 days. Terms apply. Some exclusions apply to instant rewards in which rewards are deposited when the transaction posts. This content is not investment advice, and trading crypto involves risk. For more details on rates, fees, and other cost information, see rates and fees. The Gemini credit card may not be used to make gambling-related purchases.